This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
The title of the book, Leadership Boosters, How to Make an Immediate Positive Impact on Those You Lead. And the author is T. Scott Graham, and Scott joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, and this interview is brought to you by Lulu Publishing. Hello, Scott.
Hello.
Well, great
How
to have you. Well, I'm doing great, and you've got an incredible resume. I'm looking at it. Talk about 30 years of leadership, teaching, consulting, training, coaching, speaking, and researching. So you've been down this road for a long time, and thus the book, right? You wanted to share how to best impact people who are leaders.
Exactly. You're right. 30 years, it's a pretty diverse map that I've followed to kind of get me to this point of writing this book. And all of my experiences, good and bad, have all helped me form my thoughts and my ideas of things that I share with people, both in the academic setting, and I've taught at three different universities, leadership, and certainly with a lot of organizations, both for-profit and not-for-profit, education, government. And I'm always learning. I'm continually learning. I think that's key, and that's part of why this book I felt was important to put out there. I've got my hands on a lot of leadership books. I own a lot of leadership books. They're, you know, all have their own strengths and pieces of information that have found useful, some more than others. But I just couldn't, there was not something out there like what I've written, because a lot of it is hard to get your brain around as the, okay, so that sounds great. How do I do it? It's not just, okay, it's good information, but how do I do this stuff?
Right.
How do I get better at this? So that's what I tried to do. And it's certainly not an exhaustive list of things that one can do and should do, but it's a start. And I've broken it into 10 modules, 10 chapters, if you will. And they're all laid out the same format, so people can jump into anywhere they find that the information could be helpful to them. It's not a start at the front and read your way through it. It's pick the area that you think will be most helpful to you and go right to it.
So 10 leadership skill boosters, as you call them, leadership skill boosters. And you come, again, from an incredible background of retired lieutenant colonel from the United States Air Force, where you were a B-52 crew member. So that's so unique. And, of course, then right now you're currently an assistant professor teaching at the Ohio State University.
That's right. You got to throw that.
I know.
Gotta do it.
I know. So I wanted to emphasize the Ohio State University. Well, let's kind of look at some of these skills, these leadership skill boosters that you are advocating. And before we do that, though, let's talk about how you wrote this. This is written more like you're sitting down with us and talking to us.
Well, that's the only way I really know how to write because, I've owned a lot of books, read a lot of books, have a lot of books that I've used in my teaching and training and consulting. And, the ones that are written more conversational, I find I just relate to it better. I feel like the person who wrote it is sitting there with me, talking to me over coffee. One of my favorite authors is Ken Blanchard. He wrote The 1 Minute Manager. That's the one many people have heard of, but he's written many other books, and he's been around a long time. And I like the way he writes. It's the same kind of thing. So I've sort of modeled it, not so much right after his more stories, but just that informational, kind of informal, conversational tone. And that's what I tried to do here, just like I'm sitting with you and we're having a conversation and we're talking and we're chatting about something that the people either are struggling with or just want to get better at. And I'll just tell you this, Steve, I was fortunate enough in one of my academic, not at Ohio State, but I was at another institution prior to this. And I was fortunate enough to be granted a sabbatical, which, you know, most jobs, you don't get those, you know, when you get a year off to write. And that's what I did. That's when this thing was born. because I had the time and I could take the give it the attention it needed and work with it. And that was about 5 years ago, quite honestly. And then I, from the last 5 years, I've taken the book in its draft form, and I've used it in training. I've used it in my teaching, and I've taken a lot of the input that I've gotten from those that I've taught to fold it back in to make it even better, in my view. I think it was an improvement over what I started with, because I got the user involved and tell me how this works for you. It's like, well, I didn't really understand that part. Talk to me about it. So I got a lot of input to try to make it better.
So this Leaders User's Manual, as you call it, is simple, to the point, useful, realistic, meaningful. Let's kind of jump in here and talk about a few of these leadership skill boosters, just to give everyone an idea of how you address these sometimes mind-boggling kind of subjects, because they're so critical, and a lot of times people don't know how to change. So let's just start with your first one, your first booster. Know yourself. How do you help me by reading your book to know myself?
Okay, well, I think I need to back up just a hair and tell folks why that first one was the first one. One of the things I learned many moons ago is, I learned this by working with and chatting with a lot of the smart folks at the Center for Creative Leadership out of Greensboro, North Carolina. And if people want to look what they do, ccl.org. Okay, I use them all the time. They're really, really good at what they do as far as advancing the whole knowledge world of what's going on in the world of leadership and leading successfully. So years ago, when I was down there in some workshop, and I was talking to somebody, and he shared with me some research on the number one difference maker in successful leaders and those that, as they call it, derail or become unsuccessful or never reach the level of success they want, is self-awareness. So if you don't understand your own strengths, your own weaknesses, let's just say it what it is. Some people are just have some areas they're weak in or terrible in. And if you don't know that, then how do you know where to start and what to do? So it's really a two-step process. It's knowing yourself. So knowing what your strengths are, knowing what you bring to this thing called leadership, and knowing what you don't. And then number two, what do you do about it? I mean, okay, so now I've got some information. I've asked people to give me feedback. They gave it to me. Now what do I do with that information? So it's not just knowing about yourself. And I share this in that first chapter. It's not just knowing about yourself, knowing your strengths, knowing your weaknesses, but then knowing, what do I do? How do I do this now? Now that I've got this good information to help guide me, what do I do next? And that's kind of where the rest of the boosters come in, because they're big areas. They're not all of the areas you could possibly think of, but things like coaching people, emotional intelligence, I call it people skills. That's what many of the experts who write on the subject of emotional intelligence call it, the people skills they need. And unfortunately, I think those are eroding in today's world of work. And one big reason is one of the other boosters is, how do we leverage technology, not let technology kind of overpower us, but we use it to our benefit as we lead other people. So, you know, the know yourself is the starter, and that's probably the best place for people to start, is just go there, because each of the 10 things that you assess yourself on are then laid out in the follow-on 9 boosters. And I'll just tell everyone, this is the way this book is laid out. You have a chapter, a booster, I call it, and it's focused on a particular content area or topic area of leadership. And then it's laid out by, here's some content, here's some background of why this is important, give you a little, you know, background so you understand the basis for why I'm saying this is so critical. Like, how do you coach people? How do you communicate effectively? How do you deal with change in the workplace? So it's not just getting that content. That's what you can get in any book. You can Google the content. But then it's, let's look at some sample cases that come from my own experiences. Of how does this play out? How do people do this well? How do people not do this well? Just short little stories, cases. And then I have a self-assessment, usually a 10-item, a Likert scale, which is 1 through 5, you know, strongly agree or strongly disagree. You assess yourself on these 10 areas. And then the second part of that assessment is you give it to others who know you well enough to fill it out. They fill it out on you, and then they get a third page, which is some qualitative, some sort of open-ended questions that they could fill out. And then you take all of that, look at it. That helps you know yourself in that particular area. And then in these chapters, I give you 10 ways to do this better. Now, all 10 aren't going to work for everybody. Let's say I'm looking at how to be a more effective coach, and I look at these 10 ways to be a more effective coach, to coach somebody to be successful. I might look at two of them and go, yeah, I could do those two. I think that would really fit me and the people that I'm working with. The other 8, not so much. And I say, okay, then you got 2. Start with 1. Start working on it. And that's a value add. That's a plus. Somebody got something out of the book. They learned something. They can do something with the information that they have. So to me, it makes sense. And the people that I've tested it on over the last 5 years, this book prior to it becoming a book, have told me it makes sense, you know, the format, the flow. So that's the feedback I've gotten, and I hope people who read it find it useful to them.
Can you give us an example of someone you were first, when you first met, you thought, wow, this person's never going to change? Can you give us an example of he did change or she did change and really made progress with working with people and leading people?
Yeah, I can. I'm going to start with one, though, that just jumps out in my head of someone who didn't do it right, okay? I was hired, this was probably about 8 or 9 years ago, to go into this scientific organization to help this scientist who had been recently promoted to manager, to help him, to coach him to be more successful, because he was a great scientist, award-winning, great at what he did. He was a horrible boss, horrible supervisor of these 12 people that, oh, by the way, he used to be their equal. They would work together, and then come Monday, he was promoted to boss, supervisor, and he just completely sort of had this change of personality. He just didn't know how to do it well. He didn't know how to supervise. He didn't know how to get feedback. He didn't know how to get praise. He didn't do a lot of things well. So they hired me to coach him. And within 10 minutes of meeting with him, it was crystal clear. He didn't want me there. He didn't think he needed me there. He wasn't going to do anything different. He didn't care what I said. He wanted to do it. So that was a very short conversation. It was a very short consulting engagement, because I told the person who hired me, it's never going to work. He has a horrible attitude about even me being there to help him. He doesn't think he needs help. And until he does, you're wasting your money and I'm wasting my time. So I bailed. And I found out later, they tried another coach who also realized the same thing. And they finally put him back where he belonged, which is not in a leadership role. And he was happy. So sometimes people get promoted and they shouldn't be. And they promoted for the wrong reasons. Maybe they in the job a long time and they were next up, but so it should be a kind of a mutual thing. People raise their hand to be a manager or a leader because they want to do it, not because they are forced to do it. That's when it works best. But anyway, back to your question about a successful example. Okay. I'll think about, I could list a bunch because there are a bunch, but let me focus on the area of change. Okay. I was working with this large manufacturing organization and they were going through a lot of changes, but they had a new HR director, human resources director, and he was struggling a bit, and he realized he needed help. So he went to his boss, the CEO, and said, I could use an executive coach or a coach, somebody to sort of kind of look at me from the outside looking in and give me some ideas, because it's just, I'm not really clicking with my team. I can't get them to change and all that. So what I did was I met with him. We did an assessment, not using the ones in this book, but another one that I thought fit him. And I did the 360 assessment, which is really getting a kind of a 360 degree view of yourself by asking a lot of people, your bosses, your peers, the people that report to you, people outside the organization. So I spent a lot of time and money putting that together for him. We sat down, and first he didn't want to believe the results because they weren't glowing. But after he got over the shock of that, he rolled up his sleeves and he said, okay, I'm ready to do the hard work to get to change in order to be a more successful leader. So we worked together closely for about 6 months. I would meet with him once every few weeks for about an hour over coffee and then say, how's it going? You know, give me some examples of things that are working well, things that aren't, what have you tried? And we just had the conversations. And we stayed in touch over that period of time. And he actually wanted to change. Unlike that first dude, the scientist guy who didn't want to change and he wasn't about to even consider doing anything differently, this guy really wanted to be successful. And what happened? 2 years later, I stayed with him for about 6 months, then sort of left. I stayed in touch with him, email every now and then, but he eventually was promoted to CEO of another organization. So he wanted to learn. He wanted to get better. He wanted to see where he was struggling and work on those things. And he did. So he was one of the success stories that I'm very proud of because if he wouldn't have wanted to do it, I would have been just like I was with the first guy. It wouldn't have gone anywhere. So people have to care. People have to want to change.
Yes. Change doesn't come easy, as we all know personally, but T. Scott Graham, he is the author of his book, Leadership Boosters, How to Make an Immediate Positive Impact on Those You Lead. Scott, what's the best way to get your book?
LeadershipBoosters.com.
LeadershipBoosters.com. That's simple, everyone. Well, Scott.
Yeah, or Amazon. If you just type Leadership Boosters in Amazon or Barnes & Noble, you can order it that way. You can order it via paperback or ebook. I'm old school, I guess. I like paperback because I like to use the sheets in there, like the assessments, the paper, and, you know, make copies and all that. But certainly you can do it electronically and, you know, bring yourself into the new world and get the ebook and read it on Kindle or whatever and use photocopy the sheets in there. They're all photocopiable. Use them however you see fit to help you.
Well, thank you so much, Scott, for joining us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thanks for having me, and I hope people get some real value out of this book. That's why I wrote it.
And this interview has been brought to you by Lulu Publishing.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Have you heard? The pages of American Patchwork and Quilting magazine come to life on our new weekly online radio show, American Patchwork and Quilting. Join Pat Sloan, our blogging and quilt designer host, as she talks about the latest trends, ideas, and inspirations. Her guests include quilt pattern designers, authors, quilt shop owners, and our editors. All quilters, just like you. Call in with your questions. Get quilting tips from industry experts. Learn about free patterns. Hear behind-the-scenes stories from our magazines, American Patchwork and Quilting, Quilt Sampler, and Quilts and More. Get the scoop on free stuff and find out more about the best independent quilt shops in North America. To listen to a live show, tune in Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Just log on to allpeoplequilt.com/radio. To hear past shows, go to iTunes and search for American Patchwork and Quilting Radio. We hope you'll join us because we know that quilting changes everything.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host.
Readings for Indie Book Publishing, Marchway Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book today is titled Grammar for Writers, and our author who joins me from the state of New York in the United States of America is author C. Beth Birch. Thank you for joining me, Dr. Birch.
Thank you for having me.
You have an extensive background in education, obviously, to write a book of this magnitude. You have been a professor of Judaic studies and former dean of graduate school education in Binghamton University. Why did you decide at this point that a book on grammar would be something that the world would embrace?
That's a very good question. Actually, I decided it quite a long time ago. I started my career as a high school English teacher, and luckily I had a brilliant linguistics teacher who helped prepare me to be an English teacher, and she explained all the new thinking about language and about how our contemporary methods of contemporary names, I should say, for understanding grammar didn't really fit the kinds of ways that we use grammar. So, I mean, I've been doing this a long time. I actually started using the methods that I use in this book when I was teaching high school in Oklahoma a very long time ago.
Well, this is a fascinating subject because it's complex. It reminds me of the tax laws of the United States of America. It can be very cumbersome. Do you simplify in your book?
Yes. In fact, the book is meant to be a bridge from middle school grammar, which is when most people quit getting any formal grammar instruction, to university grammar or to a more sophisticated understanding of grammar. So I would say that the methods I use here are appropriate for anyone who can sort of begin to think abstractly. And I think by junior, senior year in high school, you can do that. And so it's appropriate for just about any adult who wants to learn grammar. It helps if you have somebody work through it with you, but it is very self-explanatory if you're willing to read it.
Would you also say that the new conversational style of communication, the internet, Facebook, other social media things, have they dumbed down the conversational style, or how would you describe what's currently taking place in our culture?
Well, it's typical because language changes, and it's been changing forever since we started writing it down. So it is actually, I think it's a normal development. And so what it does, though, is bring new challenges for people to distinguish between what's good writing and what's good conversation and what's appropriate on the internet and what's appropriate in a class or a formal situation or if you're writing an op-ed. So tweeting is a lot different from writing an op-ed, for instance. So I don't think it's always been changing. It's just that sometimes the grammar we get in school is reified, it's kind of solidified because of textbooks that get used from year to year to year. And the new thinking about grammar, and I'm talking about 50 years ago, the grammar my book is based on, doesn't get put into the educational materials.
You've subtitled this.
That makes sense.
It does. You've subtitled this for writers. Is that a target audience for you? Are you looking at, as you mentioned, op-ed pieces and other things that get into firm print? Is this the audience that you feel will benefit the most from what you have described here?
Absolutely. The lots of my students have been students in creative writing classes, for instance. And it helps very much if you're a writer to understand the possibilities that you have for affecting and changing and manipulating your style to reach your audience. So what understanding grammar does for you is really give you power and control over the language that you want to use.
Language is very powerful. It can be misunderstood, even conversationally. You can say a particular phrase to someone in conversation and they may take it incorrectly. Is there a way in the written form that more or less clarifies what the intent is a little bit more than, say, the conversational style?
Well, yes, writing does tend to solidify your thinking, and it's there in print once you get it down. So that's why I think it's important to understand why you write something, how you write something, the implications of the word choice you have, and the ways that you can manipulate the writing. Yes.
Do you journal? Are you one of those writers that, you know, keeps notes and reflects back on them in order to complete a project or a task? Is that something that you do?
Sporadically. I don't do it every day, admittedly, but I keep lists. I'm a list keeper more than anything, so I keep a lot of lists, and that helps me. And I have particular files on my computer that I keep where I just put interesting stuff that I want to think about. It's just called Things to Think About.
Right. This is not your first book, though, correct?
No. In fact, this is a revision, an extensive revision of a 2003 book called A Writer's Grammar that I published with Pearson Education. It is the market for grammar books is regrettably not as large as a lot of companies would like. So the editors at Pearson declined to offer a new edition of my book. And I wanted a new edition because it needed a new edition. So they very kindly gave me my rights back. And that's why I'm going through Archway, because I wanted to see the book out. I knew it needed to be updated. And where once it was a 200-and-something page book that is currently selling on Amazon for something like $80 a book, it is now a 400-page book that sells for, in soft cover, $28.
Wow.
So an e-book, $8.99. So I wanted to make it current. I wanted to make it something affordable so that my students and grammar students everywhere and people who wanted to learn about grammar could afford to actually use the book.
448 pages, that must have taken a considerable amount of time. How much did you invest time-wise in putting your thoughts and your research together?
Countless hours. For about three times cycling through the grammar course, because I teach a course on grammar. So I took my old book, and every time I would teach it, I would mark things that needed to be developed more, corrected, where examples were getting out of date, where they, you know, where I thought it needed to be improved. So that would be at least a year of just noting what I needed to do. Then I took another about a semester, and my life is measured in semesters because I'm an academic.
Right.
So I took about another semester to actually go into the files and begin updating. And then I was very lucky to have a leave after I left the deanship of one semester. So during that time, I cleaned up all the revisions and added a chapter on usage and did research to document all the sentence examples that I have in the text, so that for every individual sentence example, and there are thousands, you can have a reference and you can go, it's in the back, and you can go read the original work that it was taken from. And of course, for some of the longer examples, I had to go get permissions because copyright laws have changed from 2003 to now.
Wow.
So I would say a good 2.5-3 years.
Is it proper to describe your personality as one that loves detail? Because there is an enormous wealth of detail in your book.
Yes, I do. But I also don't want my students to get bogged down in it. However, when we would be going through our work, because I would give them what my method is, you learn grammar by writing grammar.
Yes.
So if you are studying a particular construction, suppose you're studying the direct object pattern. So what's the best way to learn it? You go home and write it. So we study it in class. We look at examples. We look at how students use it. We talk about how it's the most common pattern in English, you know, Johnny hit Sammy. And then their assignment is to go home and write. And I find that they need to write at least 30 examples before they run out of steam. And if they're going to make a mistake, it'll be after it'll be later in the process when you're getting tired and a little bit tired of writing sentences. You've written 25 or 26 sentences and you can't think of any more verbs and you can't think of anything else to write. And then you make a mistake. And that's how we refine our understanding of the concepts in the book, is by making mistakes. And I found that when we get in class and we talk about the mistakes, that's when the detail comes up. You know, it's like, oh, you know, I didn't think of it this way. Or, oh, no wonder. So it gets more detailed as I got to be a better teacher, got more detailed.
Right. Anecdotally, in thinking of your history as a professor, teacher, and involved in the language industry, is there a story that might be kind of fun to reflect on, maybe an achievement of one of your students or something else that you might want to share?
I don't know. I can't think of anything. I've had so many wonderful students who have done so many fine things. But I can tell you that the reason that I wrote the original book in 2003 was that a student came to me at the end of class. We were using three other textbooks that I will not name. And she said, now that at the end of class, I finally can read the textbook that was our main textbook. Mm. She said, I think I need to take the course again because now I can read the textbook. She said, why don't you write a textbook that will be a bridge to that more difficult textbook? So I thought, that's a really good idea. So I did that, and that's what my original book published in 2003 did. And then when I was teaching the grammar course in about 2013, we were lamenting the price of the book and how students were buying used books, which of course doesn't do the author any good, and they were falling apart. And so they were taking them to Kinko's FedEx and getting them hole punched and made into a little, you know, loose leaf notebook. And one of the students said, you know, Dr. Birch, you should make this into an ebook. Then everybody could afford it. And I thought, yes. So I think maybe I should say that both of my ideas for writing these books came from students.
Wow.
Who needed a better way.
Dr. Birch, one of the complex issues for many is punctuation. How do you approach that topic?
I approach it in what I think is an unusual way, and that is I look at, there's a chapter that is a guide to each individual punctuation mark. For example, there's a little chapter on commas. And so you get the traditional rules about how we use commas and what are the standard rules. And there are examples of those, many sentences. But then there are examples of ways that authors have used commas that may be a little untraditional and may be used in specific circumstances. So I even give you give the reader information about how to use apostrophes and the em dash, and exclamation points and that sort of thing. So I think that it's a supplement to what I do in the text, which is show when you use punctuation marks, but it also breaks out the marks so that you can get a better sense of the actual individual piece. For example, and this is the only one I'll give, is that the semicolon is one of the most misused and least understood punctuation marks of all time. So I try to make it clear when you use semicolons and when you don't, and colons as well. So this is one of the unusual things I think about the book.
Well, I should probably read that chapter. I am profound in the use of semicolons, not semicolons, but in exclamation marks, especially in social media, LOL. So I probably need to look at that chapter.
That would be fine. Call me up if you have any questions.
I gotcha. All righty. This is a book that will appeal to anybody that wants to get it right. It has wonderful research and cookie trails they can follow if they want to get in deeper into the language that we call English, and also the grammar usage. The title of the book, again, is Grammar for Writers, and my guest has been Dr. C. Beth Birch. Where can my listeners get a copy of this, Dr. Birch?
Well, they can get a copy of it at cbethbirch.com. That's B-U-R-C-H. Or they can go on, they can go to their Barnes & Noble store and order a copy. They can go online and get it at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and lots of online outlets.
Fabulous. They can also request it from their local bookseller by requesting it by name, Grammar for Writers, Dr. C. Beth Birch. Thank you for joining me today and for simplifying a very complex subject and sharing it with the world. Thanks again for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Jay.
My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing, Archway Press, this is Jay Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
It's the Fitness Minute with fitness expert Annette Hammond.
When your focus is to lose weight or maintain your present weight, exercising effectively to burn the most calories is crucial. You want to give yourself every advantage to burn as many calories as possible. One good tip is to do your strength training exercises standing up so you can keep your heart rate up. Another tip is to perform multi-joint exercises when you can. For example, as you're doing a forward lunge, add bicep curls while you're coming up from the lunge. Another example is to execute a wide squat, and as you're coming up from the squat, perform a shoulder press. By doing these multi-joint exercises, you're putting more demands on your body, keeping your heart rate up, and working more muscles at the same time. The goal is to burn the most calories during that workout. I'm Annette Hammond. To hear other fitness and weight loss tips, visit our website at AnnetteHammond.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The title of the book is Where's the Salt? With a question mark. And my author who joins me from the Carolinas is Stephen S. Purdy. Welcome, sir, to the program.
Thank you, and good to hear from you.
Well, this is a book that is a relatively short read. There must have been some inspiration behind it, and the title itself is unique. Where did the inspiration for the title come from, and what motivated you to write this?
The story is a bit of a long one. I've heard people speak in sermons and just regular talks about things in the Bible where people would be reading it, and then you listen to someone say, "Did you see what else was there?" And I happen to be just thinking about Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, and I've been trained as a physicist and chemist, and I've handled chemicals and been in laboratories pretty much a lot of my life. And it sort of hit me like a ton of bricks when rereading the Jesus' words about salt. And if, in essence, that salt would lose its savor. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, okay, nobody's ever really talked about it. And it involves the concept of how do you corrupt salt so it's not salty.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost impossible to do that with a chemical. You can try in the laboratory, but folks have discovered that you can dilute salt down to an awful low percentage, and it will your taste buds will still detect salt.
Interesting.
It's there. It's really, really hard to conceive of how would you destroy salt so that it wouldn't be able to do any of the things that folks normally expect salt to do. And in the little book, it could have been a huge book, but I figured, you know, not everybody wants to learn all of the different things that salt can do, except for the major ones. But it does so many things. And if all of a sudden it couldn't, there are so many processes and so many things in our life today that would actually come to a halt and stop and cease to be good if that happened. And I never really heard anybody talk about it, and it became a burden on my heart to dig into it and possibly try to come up with something that might explain it some.
Because of your career background, then, this became more than just an observation of Matthew chapter 5, which is the Sermon on the Mount. It became a research project as well.
It did, and it's not just research, but philosophically speaking, how do you take something that has basically been a standard without fail for thousands of years, and how do you ruin it? And I tried to explore it a little bit, and it happens that Jesus used something that people would possibly just stop maybe at the time and wonder, because at the time that Jesus was speaking, salt was an extremely expensive commodity.
Yes.
It was hard to get. You'd think, why? You know, you've got right next to the Mediterranean Ocean, which is full of salt, but getting good salt back then meant to find mined salt. It had to come from a salt mine or something like that. They didn't have the purified, if it rains, it pours, kind of salt that mm-hmm. we have today. It was mined and probably better for you, but it was still a combination of sodium and chlorine.
And what did
it's
you
interesting.
What did you hope to achieve by the content of your book? Again, it's a short read, but you must have had somebody in mind that you wanted to inspire by the discoveries that you have shared.
I did. It was people who don't realize that they are being called on to be salt in this world. In other words, to stand up for what they know is right, and to not back away from it, to be what they're supposed to be. Salt is very hard to change, and it's interesting. It has a cubic crystalline structure, and even if you, no matter how small you grind salt, it retains that same cubic structure. And we're called on to maintain our character, our relationship to God, all of those things, were being called on it. And if that is destroyed, that affects not just our own lives, but the lives of people all around us who might be expecting us to do the right thing.
You have also highlighted some, you know, obvious things that people know from experience, things like salt melts ice, but there is a philosophical interpretation of that as well.
That's right. It being pure can melt the ice that forms over someone's heart and mind to prevent them from actually trying to listen to what God might be wanting to speak to them.
You have also highlighted salt as a standard reference system. Salt has power. Salt even puts out fire. I had not really thought about that, but there's some other things that you mentioned. Salt has there's a warning in salt. The book itself, how long did it take to write, Stephen?
It took quite a while because I didn't want it to be a long, drawn out affair. I didn't want it to be too technical. I didn't want it to be too preachy. I wanted it to be something written to allow someone to grasp the concept, hopefully without a lot of effort, and get the message. The most effective things that I've come across in my life are not the biggest ones. They're the smallest ones, where the idea comes across, and I actually had to struggle with it a little bit because it would have been easy just to possibly consider doing a few pages, but it wouldn't have really fleshed it out. So I tried to strike a balance between getting the message across and not being like boring and extra long and having all kinds of extra things on. I mean, there's if you start researching salt, you could write volumes and volumes enough to fill a small library.
What was the warning that James Madison gave in 1787 that you highlight?
I think I'd have to go back and actually look at my own book for that one. Do you happen to have that with you?
I do have it in front of me. He was the fourth president of the United States and author of the Federalist Papers, and he had a lot to say about morality and principle, and this ties together. He's quoted as saying, "No man can be a competent legislator who does not add up to an upright intention and a sound judgment and a certain degree of knowledge of the subject on which he has what he is legislating. The truth is that all men have power ought to be mistrusted. That certainly works today in our contemporary society, doesn't it?
It certainly does. It certainly does. It has to. You cannot ignore what is happening around you, and a person who has lost the ability to do that is a person who is beginning to lose their grip on salt and can't be counted on to give a good answer.
You have, again, focused on the background of salt and its importance in society and how it impacts our lives and can impact our culture. You also have dealt with the philosophical side and have brought in other quotes from other people like Benjamin Franklin and others who were the founding principles of the United States Constitution. So this is a little broader range than just focusing on Chapter 5 of Matthew and the Beatitudes. You could also say this book would be a great reference point for Bible teachers and care groups. Is that also something you had in mind?
I would be delighted if they would use it. I felt during the, you asked me how long it took. During that entire time, it was a concept I could not get rid of. You may know that I'm not an author. This is my first book. Writing isn't something I do for recreation, but I could not shake an urgent prompting to go back and work on the book and put it into print, give it birth. I would like the concept, be delighted if that concept would be shared.
Beautiful. Well, thank you for sharing your story. And the title again is Where's the Salt? Stephen,
yes,
have you been able to get any responses from people that have read your book? What's the response been?
I did get some responses from some people. I sent a copy of one of them to Franklin Graham and got a very nice note back from him. I also sent a copy to Dr. Dobson and his organization. I didn't get an answer from him, but I got an answer saying that they really appreciated it. I got a very good old friend, and I only say old because we're both a little bit, but I've known him for 40 years, and he said he couldn't say enough nice things about it. So I'm feeling very encouraged that it does, and a few other people, just friends that I know where I live, really liked it.
My author, Stephen S. Purdy, P-U-R-D-Y, has been my guest. Stephen, there are listeners who will want to get a copy of this. How do they do so?
They can get a copy of it by going, I believe, to Amazon. They can go to lulu.com. They can Google Where's the Salt, and they will find several different booksellers that will be able to sell it to them, either in print form or in ebook form.
And usually Amazon will have an excerpt on their page if it's shown out there, so that might be also something that would be of interest to my listeners. They can do a search on the title again, Where's the Salt, or under your name, Stephen with a V, E-N-S, Purdy, P-U-R-D-Y. They also can request this from their local booksellers by name, and they can order it on their behalf as well. Thank you for joining me today. Is there another book in the future at this point, or is that something that you're kind of waiting to see what will happen with Where's the Salt?
I'm probably going to be waiting to see a little bit of what happens with the book and also whether I receive prompting to go ahead and come up with something additional.
Well, thank you for joining me today and sharing your story.
Thank you very much, sir. Pleasure talking with you.
My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing. Join us again next week at noon Eastern.